You're listening to Crosspoint Community Church in LaGrange, Texas podcast. To learn more about Crosspoint Community Church, including service times and how you can connect, please visit crosspointchurchtx.org.
Well, Merry Christmas. Man, I love when those ladies get together and they just start worshiping together and singing. You can just hear it, doesn't it? Like, that's what heaven's going to be like. And how many of you got your Christmas stuff ready to roll? A couple of you. Like, some of you, I heard some of you, like, you don't even have your Christmas tree out yet, and you're even wondering if it's going to be Christmas this year or whatever. And it's just because of the busyness of the season. I get it. And but that's the one time of year for the last 2 or 3 years that Becky and I have been married that we fight about is the Christmas tree. Do you ever have that? And so we've just decided that I will bring in all the Christmas bins. I will set everything out and make it accessible to her. And I will set the tree up because that's where you can get hurt doing all that stuff and put that in. And we no longer fight at Christmas. And so it's just a beautiful thing. I watch whatever I want to watch, not a Hallmark movie, and things are good. And so anyway, so it's that time of the year. And so I'm glad that you're here. And part of the thing about Christmas that we enjoy, a lot of it has to do with there's some traditions that maybe as a community, but also individually in the family that you look forward to every year. And one of those things around here is Silent Night, singing of the Silent Night and that song. And that song is now sung in over 300 different languages around the world. And it's considered the most popular Christmas song ever recorded, ever written. And it had a humble beginning. And I was just thinking about this as I was preparing for this, this idea of over 300 languages singing the same song. And that is, in many ways, I imagine that's what heaven will be like. Is that there will be many languages, tribes, and tongues, and we'll all sing, but we may not know the language, but we'll understand it. And I had a recent experience like that. I was in Israel a few years ago, and we were at the place where many believe potentially where Jesus was buried or somewhere like this in the cave. And there was different little platforms. So you're in the garden and you're looking at this cave, and I was in the lowest setting with a group of people, and there were other groups behind us in different settings, different groups. And we were singing some worship songs. We'd just taken the Lord's Supper communion with this group, and then all of a sudden we started singing, and then we started singing a song, and I'm like, you know, you're singing, you're listening, and all of a sudden I'm like, that's more than the 20 of us. And I turn around, and there's another like 400 or 500 people in different stations singing with us. And I was like, man, that's heaven. That I didn't know they were singing Portuguese, some were singing, and they were from South Korea, and so all different languages. And it's just like, that is to God, that has got to be the most pleasing sound of his children from around the world in unison praising Jesus. And so that around the world in this season, that there are songs that we sing that are traditions, but even more importantly, they set our hearts and our minds aright toward God, and that we're singing in unison, maybe for the one time in a year that we're in unison together with that. And so this idea of a silent night and a holy night wrapped around this babe. And now that it's a song that we all know, but it had very humble beginnings. It was actually written for a small congregation in Merrifar, Australia, by a priest that it was his very first parish. He's a young guy. And in the midst of all this, what had just happened in Austria in about 1815 was the Napoleonic Wars had just ended. Y'all heard about that guy, Napoleon. He was kind of a busy dude. And in the midst of that, as the war was ending, there was a volcano that erupted, and so it impacted this community and the area around it. And because of that, not only were they ending the wars and the trauma of that, not only did they have this volcanic eruption and the trauma of that, they were now in the midst of famine and then obviously hunger and everything. So you can imagine they were poverty stricken. All of their world that they had known had been disrupted for a while. And now they've got this young priest who comes in and says, how can I offer hope in the midst of this? And so he wrote a poem that we now know as Silent Night. It was Silent Nacht to them, but he wrote it. And then he took this poem to his friend, Franz Gruber. And Franz Gruber was a school teacher in a nearby town, but he was also one of the organists that would travel around and play. Y'all have heard of those things called organs? Y'all remember those things? But they didn't have an organ because of everything going on. There had also been a flood. And so this priest had lost his organ due to the flood. And so he needed something to be written that could be played on a guitar and could be easily sung. And so Joseph Moore, And Franz Gruber put together this poem and this music together. And it was a little bit faster speed than what we sing today. They've changed it a little bit, and there were actually originally six verses. But these two guys wrote the poem, they wrote the music, and then that night, on Christmas Eve in 1818, in this little village of Mirafar, Austria, they sang Silent Night for the first time. And soon after that, another guy had heard it who was also an organ player. And he would go actually from village to village with some folk singers. He would play his organ and they would have folk singers. And he introduced the song to Austria and it began to grow rapidly until we get to a little bit later in history in the late 1800s. It makes it to America through this thing called, how many of y'all have heard? I know y'all have heard of organ, some of you. How many of y'all have heard of this word hymnal? Y'all know what a hymnal is, okay? And in the hymnal, a Sunday school hymnal in the late 1800s, it made it to America for the first time. And as we know, we still sing it today. Again, it's considered the most famous Christmas song in history. Bing Crosby sang it and has made a lot of money for him and his family now for generations with his version. And like I said, it's being sung in over 300 different languages. And it's a song that brought hope and peace to a parish in Mirafar, Austria over 200 years ago, and today it still brings that same message to us, and that we're reminded that a babe wrapped in swaddling clothes brings hope and peace and joy and love. And today I want to share a story with you that's not a traditional Christmas story, but it's a story of an orphan in the midst of captivity that stepped up when it was time to step up and brought salvation to her people. It was a tumultuous time for the Hebrews. They were in captivity. They've been taken captive by the Babylonians. Y'all know King Nebuchadnezzar. I talked about him last week. And now they're still under captivity, but they're under Persian rule. And at this specific time, they're under the rule of King Xerxes. And King Xerxes, up to that point, he was the wealthiest king that had ever been. He was under the wealthiest kingdom. He had a lot of money. He had a lot of power. He had a lot of authority. And so times were good in Persia. Even for the Jewish people that were in captivity, times were good. It was a time of relative peace. As you know, we talked a little bit about Cyrus had already kind of sent some people back, and so there's that movement back, but they're still technically under captivity. And in the midst of this, King Xerxes decides to have a party. Now, when we think of a party, we think of like, hey, come at 6, it's going to end at midnight. You know, if it gets really crazy, it might go to 2, right? Well, King Xerxes, through the party of all parties, he sent out a note to everyone that was in his kingdom that was of any consequence, princes, whatever, whoever they were. If they were anybody, they got an invite, and they got to come to this party. And this party, you guys, was 180 days. That's a party. Imagine calling Best Western and saying, hey, I need a hotel room. And they're like, for a couple of nights, you know, I need 181. Because the party's 180, I'm going to need at least one day to recover, right? And so you got that going on. So for 180 days, there's a party and the opulence. And you can read in the book of Esther the opulence which he had. People were drinking out of gold goblets. There were pearl stone couches. I mean, all this different stuff. All of his wealth was on full display for all of the kingdom to see. And there was multiple reasons that he would do this. But one, to put people in good graces. But then also the power and authority that he had and all the things that he had won in all of his victories. And so you get to see that too. And so after the 180-day party, you would think there's things to be done in the kingdom, right? Well, let's throw another little party. So as everybody's going back, King Xerxes says, hey, listen, for those that are my closest friends and closest to me in the city of Susa, where he's at, he threw another 7-day party. And in this 7-day party, because these were his closest friends, he just said, hey, listen, I need y'all to know the alcohol will continue to flow. So obviously he was an Imran. So there was a lot of alcohol going. So you can imagine for 7 days, no one is saying no. The tap is continually opening. And this is just for the men, okay? And then because of that, Queen Vashti said, well, shoot, we cannot just let the guys have all the alcohol they want. She throws her own party too. And so two parties are going on together. And on the 7th day at the end of this party, King Xerxes sends a note to Queen Vashti and says, hey, listen, you're the hottest of hotties in this kingdom. I need you to come and show off how beautiful you are to all the guys. Now you can imagine 180-day party, and we don't know how long the break, if there was a break, and then there's a 7-day party where there's unlimited amounts of alcohol. It's getting crazy. And she's thinking to herself, there ain't no way I'm going to go into that party because I may never get out of there. And so she tells King Xerxes no. Well, listen, even if you're the queen, you don't get to tell the king no if he doesn't want to. And so King Xerxes was mad, obviously, partially because he was embarrassed. You can imagine also he's drunk. Everyone else is drunk, even his wise men. So he got together with them in his anger, and he said, what are we going to do about this? Queen Vashti said, no, I'm not going to come in. I'm frustrated. I'm mad and embarrassed by this. And the wise men of his council gathered around, and they said, listen, if the queen can say no to the king in his castle, that means at my castle where I'm king, that means my queen can model after your behavior and say no too. We can't have that. So you need to do something about this Queen Vashti. You need to put her in place and to banish her and to let our wives know that they can't talk to us like Queen Vashti talked to you. Sounds like good advice, right, guys? I'm kidding. Don't beat me up later. All right. They banished her. Queen Vashti was banished from the kingdom. And after a little bit of time, King Xerxes is like, I actually miss having my wife around. And so because of that, he put out an edict. And he put together the biggest beauty pageant that had ever been known, except for Miss America, I guess. And sent that out and invited all the beautiful women. So he had teams. He had all these guys called eunuchs. And these eunuchs would go around, and they would find the most beautiful women, and they would bring them into the kingdom. And as they were in there in the kingdom together, they would have 12 months of beauty treatments. And so if you were picked as one of those young, beautiful women to be a part of this whole scenario, you got one full year of free sauna and spa days. And some of you women, like, sign me up for that. And so they had that. And so there was going on for a year, and there was this guy named Haggai, who was the top of the king's eunuchs and cared for his people and particularly for the ladies of his court. And he saw this young woman by the name of Hadassah. And Hadassah was a Jewish orphan who had been adopted by her cousin. And her cousin worked in the king's court. He knew a little bit. He wasn't high up in the court, but he was there. And he was someone, his name was Mordecai. And Mordecai was someone's family heritage. They were Jews. And his family worked in the court of King Jehoiakim. And King Jehoiakim was the king of Israel, the southern kingdom of Judah, when Nebuchadnezzar came in and took over Jerusalem and took over the temple and destroyed the temple. And so that's a part of Mordecai's heritage. He's been in the upper echelons of leadership and community as a family, and so he understands the inner workings of the king's court and all of that. And so whenever he finds out that his niece, Hadassah, that he's adopted as his daughter, is going to be one of these people, he gives her wise things to know and to think about and to say and to not say. And one of the things he told her is, listen, you need to not let people know that you are Jewish. You need to hold that quiet, hold that close to your vest, and don't tell anyone unless you absolutely have to do that. And so she was wise. She listened to him. And so here in the midst of all this, this eunuch Haggai really began to see something different in this Jewish orphan girl named Hadassah and gave her extra special treatments, gave her an extra special diet, and actually brought in some of the king's servant ladies that were close to the king, brought in seven of them to give extra care and advice and counsel to Hadassah so that when her time came, whenever her lottery number was picked and she got to spend the night with King Xerxes, that she would get the thumbs up and potentially become the next queen. And so all these other ladies had gone through, and every time that someone would go in, they got to pick whatever jewelry, whatever they wanted to wear so that they could present themselves to the king. And ultimately, then it comes Hadassah, who we know as Esther today, presented herself, and she sought out Haggai, and she sought out the servants and said, how should I present myself to King Xerxes? And they told her, she listened to their advice, and she went in, she presented herself to the king, and as we know today, she actually became the next queen. But she never disclosed that she was Jewish. She'd impressed the king with her beauty and with her wisdom and all the things that she said to him and how she presented herself, but she never presented that she was Jewish. And so that's the setting of the story, is that here King Xerxes has put together a beauty pageant. Hadassah, who we know as Esther, is now the queen. And Mordecai, who's been around the king's court, now gets a little bit higher place in the court because the queen kind of elevated him a little bit. And this is going on. And so in the midst of all this, as soon as Mordecai gets raised up, there's this other guy by the name of Haman. And Haman had been raised up as well, and now he's second in command of all of of Persia. And so you got King Xerxes, and now you got Haman that's underneath him. And so Haman is a guy who has some pride issues and thinks a lot of himself. And he's stepped over people and done whatever he could to get into this place. And he's going to do whatever he can to keep himself in that position. Well, he continues to see this guy, Mordecai, and he sees that Mordecai somehow or another has some influence. And it angers him and it frustrates him. And so he kind of keeps that in the back of his mind. Well, Mordecai one day is coming into Susa. He's coming into the fortress, and he overhears some guards, and they're frustrated with King Xerxes, and they decide they're in the middle of planning an assassination plot. And so Mordecai hears this, takes it to Queen Esther, and then Esther takes it to King Xerxes. Xerxes is kind of shocked by it. He does some investigation, and come to find out, lo and behold, those guards had begun an assassination plot. And so they take those guys out, and in the records of the kings, King Xerxes and his chroniclers wrote, hey, there was a guy named Mordecai who told us about this assassination plot, and then because of that, that saved the king's life. But nothing ever happened except for that little chronicle being written. Well, in the meanwhile, again, Haman's anger's growing. He's more frustrated. And so now Haman has this second in command. He has the king's signet ring, and he wears his robes, and anywhere he goes, it's as if he's the king everywhere. And so you can imagine the power and authority and the pride and everything that's building within him. Well, Haman says, hey, listen, anywhere I go, since I'm the representative of the king, you bow down to the king, you also have to bow down to me. Well, Mordecai, being a Jew, that's a faithful Jew, Mordecai would walk by, everybody else would bow down, and Mordecai's like, mm-mm, not happening. Well, then people begin to question Haman and say, listen, why do you make everyone else bow down, but this one guy, Mordecai, doesn't have to? Which, again, frustrated Haman, because he continues to see him, and now this guy's causing a little stir for him because he's not being obedient and he's not bowing down. And so he becomes enraged, and he then goes to King Xerxes and he says, hey, listen, there's this people that they really frustrate me. They don't have a good reputation. They're just whatever, whatever. I would like for you to issue a decree to eradicate all of them on a certain day. Do you give me the power and authority and money and the military to do this? And King Xerxes, under his influence, says, yes, you can. And again, gives him the power and authority to do that. And so he does this thing called lots. He would take basically playing dice, and he would roll the dice. He took his spiritual advisors, and they rolled dice, and they decided on the date of March 7th that was the day that the gods had chosen. On March 7th of the next year, they would eradicate the Jewish people. And so Haman, under the power and authority of King Xerxes, sent a decree to the ends of the kingdom, and it began to become knowledgeable. The Jews became knowledgeable of this fact that under the power and authority of King Xerxes, Haman was going to eradicate them. So Mordecai received this word as well, and he's obviously distraught about it, and he goes and talks to this woman named Esther that he knows well, right, who has the king's ear, and she's hesitant to approach the king. For you see, you have to understand that to approach the king in his court, you can be welcome in or you can be not welcomed in. And if you're not welcomed in, most likely you're going to die. You're going to be executed because you're trying to get the audience of the king and it's not your time and he doesn't like you. There's a reason that he's not letting you in. And Queen Esther says to Mordecai, hey, listen, it's been at least 30 days since I've had an audience with the king, privately or publicly. I haven't been in his presence in a long time. And so Mordecai responds to her in this way. Mordecai sent a reply to Esther, don't think for a moment that because you're in the palace, you will escape when all other Jews are killed. If you keep quiet at a time like this, deliverance and relief for the Jews will arise from some other place, but you and your relatives will die. Who knows if perhaps you were made queen for just such a time as this? Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go and gather together all of the Jews of Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. My gals and I will do the same. And then, through it, though it is against the law, I will go in to see the king. If I must die, I must die. Now, that's brave. That's courageous. That she's like, hey, listen, I guess, Mordecai, I hear you that maybe this is, and I have the entire kingdom at my disposal, but maybe the reason I'm here is not for all the things for me, but maybe it's for my people. And so she begins to take this in, and she says, hey, listen, I'm going to take 3 days. I'm going to pray about it. I need you to fast with me as well to put courage in. And so that at that moment, whenever I go before the king, hopefully, above all hopes, he will receive me and accept me in. And so after the third day of the fasting and praying, she goes and puts on her royal robes and I'm sure fancied and gussied herself up, as they say. And she walked into the king's hall and she stands outside of the king's court in all of her beauty and all of her glory and stands there and waits, hoping that King Xerxes will see her and will receive her. Well, thankfully, as we know the story, we see that King Xerxes sees her. He's enamored with her beauty, and he invites her in. And what he would do is he would lower his gold scepter to her, and she would come in. Like, that's the opening of the gate. And so she would come in, and then she would touch the scepter as receptive to his invitation. And so they begin to have a discussion, and she says, hey, you look good today. I haven't seen you in a long time. What are we having for dinner? You know, those kind of conversations is what I imagine. And then at some point, he's like, okay, you got all dressed up. Why are you here? She says, well, actually, what I want to do is I want to invite you, and I want you to invite your second in command, Haman, to a banquet that I have prepared just for the two of you tonight. And he said, okay. He goes, but I'm willing to give you up to half of the kingdom. And she says, I understand, and I appreciate that, but for today, all I want is to invite you and Haman to a banquet for tonight. And so they do. They go to that. And again, at their banquet, it's just Esther and the king and Haman. And he then, as they're having their drink and having their food, the king looks at her and says, okay, now listen, surely you want more from me than just my presence at a banquet. And she said, yeah, I do, but I would really just like to invite you and Haman to another banquet. And can we have that banquet tomorrow night? And he's like, sure, I'll make sure that that happens. And as Haman's leaving that banquet, he sees this guy, Mordecai. And it angers him. But one, because Mordecai didn't bow down, and he's like, why is this guy? And so he goes back to his house, and he tells his wife, and he tells his friends, this guy, Mordecai, is just like, he's that rock in your shoe. He's just always around. He bugs me. I can't get rid of him. No matter how hard I shake my foot, he's always there. I want to do away with him. I cannot wait for March the 7th. And so their people are like, hey, listen, maybe you don't have to wait for March the 7th. I mean, maybe you can get rid of Mordecai before the March the 7th date. And he's like, well, what can I do? And he said, well, why don't you build some gallows? And in the middle of the night, you can take Mordecai and you can have him killed. Well, when we think of gallows, we think of the hanging things. But in those days, the gallows were actually traditionally, they were a pole, a tree, at least 75 foot tall, and they would shape the end of it to make it look like a really, really sharp pencil. Do y'all remember pencils when you would go to school and you would stand at the thing and do that? So imagine doing that, and they got this really sharp pole at 75 feet, and they would throw you on it and impale you. So this is what Haman thought was going to be a good thing for Mordecai, and so he was working that out in his mind, and he'd gotten that done, and he'd actually built it in his own backyard, just outside of the king's court. And so in the midst of that, that's all going on. Well, after that banquet, that first night, King Xerxes is back at home. He can't sleep. He's got insomnia or whatever. God wakes him up, and he begins to read. To go back to sleep, he begins to read the chronicles of his kingdom. And as the person's reading through it to him, all of a sudden he hears about the story of Mordecai, and he's reminded, oh yeah, this guy did something and it saved my life. And he asks the question, what did we do to show him honor and respect for what he did for me? And somebody says, we did nothing. And he's like, oh my goodness, we should do something for this guy, Mordecai. He saved my life. And so the very next thing in the morning, this guy Haman walks in, again, full of himself. He's building this little gallows for himself so he can take care of Mordecai. And he comes in and the king says, hey, Haman, let me ask you a question. If someone did something for the king, what should we do to honor them? So that everyone will know that what this person and what they do pleases the king. And Haman thinking, oh, he's talking about me. Well, he should get the king's signet ring. He should get some royal robes that the king has worn. As a matter of fact, to even make this even better, he should ride one of the king's horses that he's ridden in after a triumphal victory. And you should have someone that's walking that horse in front of him pronouncing the great acts of this guy. Because he's thinking, hey, he's going to talk about Haman and all this different stuff. And he goes, great, that is a perfect idea. Quick, go get that guy Mordecai and let's do this. And of course, Haman is livid, thinking it's him. And all of a sudden, it's his mortal enemy. He's, as a matter of fact, he's trying to get rid of this guy. And so here we go. And then this happens. You can imagine Haman excitedly taking Mordecai through town and pronouncing the works of Mordecai. And then imagine going home and going, you know what I mean? All the things that he's saying that he's got going on. And his wife's like, listen, I'm sorry. And right as he's in the middle of our the servants of King Xerxes knock on the door and say, hey, don't forget, you've got a banquet to be at tonight with King Xerxes and Queen Esther. And he's like, oh yeah. And so he goes. In the midst of all this, they're laying on what we have been told is like this long couch. They're laying together, eating together. And again, the king says, hey, what do you need from me, Queen Esther? Why are we really doing this? Again, up to and half of my kingdom I will give to you if you ask it. And she says to him in this moment, listen, what I need you to know is something you don't know about me, is that I'm your queen, and we've experienced a lot together. You know a lot about me, but the one thing that you don't know that's maybe the most important thing is that I'm actually a Jew. And why that's important to you and important for you to know now is that in a few months, you've passed an edict and a decree throughout the entire kingdom, and that even you, king, because you've issued the decree, you are subject to its law and sovereignty, that all of the Jews on March 7th will be eradicated and assassinated, including me. Well, you can imagine King Xerxes, he was angry and frustrated, and so he gets up from the couch and walks away for a moment, trying to, I'm sure, think about what's he going to do. He goes, I'm liking this woman and all the things that are going on there. And in the midst of that, Haman realizes, oh, dookie, my plan is going awry, all right? And so what does he do? He throws himself at the feet of Queen Esther. Well, just at that moment, King Xerxes turns around and he sees what he perceives as an assault. And so immediately he sends his guards, and his guards tells us that they put their hands over his mouth and they put him in a headlock, and they say, what do you want us to do with this guy that's assaulting Queen Esther? And he says, I don't know. And one of the guys says, hey, I got an idea. Haman's actually been building this gallows for this guy Mordecai. Why don't we use it for him? And King Xerxes says, great idea. When do you think we should do it? And they're like, well, it's finished. And so immediately in that moment, they marched Haman to his own gallows and tossed him off the top, and he was impaled over his own gallows. From that, King Xerxes gave Haman's wealth and all of his servants and all the things that were once Haman's, gave it all over to Queen Esther, who then gave it over to Mordecai to care for and to make sure that it would continue to be in the family, gave Mordecai his signet ring from Haman, and gave him all the power and authority that had once been Haman's was now Mordecai's. And because of that, then, there was a new edict and decree that was announced throughout the entire people. And it reminded that, hey, this March 7th date was coming, but I want you to know that I've given permission and authority and power to the Jewish people to defend themselves to the point of death. And they can actually begin the fighting on March 6th to make sure that you don't fight them. So because of that, there was celebration and joy throughout the entire land, especially for the Jewish people, because God had provided for them through this orphan girl by the name of Hadassah that no one would ever known, that had the courage to say, if I must perish, I will perish for my people. Even in the midst of captivity, when we think that God isn't for us or caring for us and worried about the details of our life, God continually shows throughout Scripture that even in the moment where we think we are forgotten, that He is intimately caring for and working out the details of our lives and His sovereignty behind the scenes, and will use the most unwary person, an orphan girl whose parents have passed away, has an opportunity to save her people. In a land that wasn't theirs, the Jews, it even tells us that even in that land, because of that decree and because of how God provided salvation for his people in that land, many people became followers of Yahweh because of God's provision for them. And so even today, the Jewish people celebrate this through a holiday called Purim, because the lots that Haman tossed were called Purs. And so the Jewish people are constantly reminded of the holiday of Purim and God's salvation provided to them through an orphan girl named Hadassah and her willingness to say, if I perish, I must perish. It's a consistent theme for God's people throughout history. Not only did salvation come through an orphan girl in a foreign land, salvation came through an orphan boy that was found in a basket in a river. And now today we celebrate, here's a boy born a babe in swaddling clothes, wasn't as king as many thought he should be, but born in a stable. Matter of fact, we read it in Luke chapter 2. It says, and because Joseph was a descendant of King David, he had to go to Bethlehem in Judea, David's ancient home. And he traveled there from the village of Nazareth in Galilee. And he took with him Mary, to whom he was engaged, who was now expecting a child. And while they were there, the time came for the baby to be born. And she gave birth to her firstborn son. She was wrapped in strips of cloth and laid him in a manger because there was no lodging for them. Salvation came through a babe wrapped in swaddling clothes in a stable, and no one even recognized that he was born. The complete opposite of how a king would have been announced. Maybe Jesus is born and it's quiet. Now, we know that there were some shepherds that had got some attention, but for the entire world, most of it was quiet. And then we find this moment at the end of Jesus' life that sounds a lot like the moment between Mordecai and Esther. And here it is in Luke 22. Jesus walked a little bit away. He's in the Garden of Gethsemane, about a stone's throw, and knelt down and prayed, Father, if you're willing, please take this cup of suffering away from me. Yet I want your will to be done, not mine. In other words, if I may perish and have to perish, I will perish. Salvation, the greatest gift offered to his people. The creator of the universe has looked down upon us, and throughout our own personal history, throughout our family's history, he's intervened at exactly the right time and exactly the right moment. And as we talked about last week, the perfect moment in all of history, the King of Kings and Lord of Lords was born in Bethlehem in the most inefficient way that it could possibly be done. And now here we are 2,000 years later, and there's songs that are being sung to proclaim his name in all of the languages of the world, and it sounds like heaven to him. And even though we may be in a season where it doesn't feel like there's peace, it doesn't feel like there's much love or joy or happiness, in the midst of this, we can sing his praises because we know that he has won the victory. Because time after time after time, he's provided salvation, complete salvation for his people in the moment when they needed it. And for you and I, through Christ, salvation has come. My prayer is, you don't miss the greatest gift that's ever been offered in the person of Jesus Christ. Let's pray together. Dear Heavenly Father, thank you for Jesus. Thank you for the greatest gift that the world has ever known. In all of history, it's this babe wrapped in swaddling clothes. And Father, because we know the end of the story, we know that this babe wrapped in swaddling clothes gives his life, we're even more thankful because we understand the cost of this gift. And Father, even today as we celebrate the birth of Jesus, we cannot do it without recognition of the cost of the gift. So Father, I pray this morning that as we focus our hearts and minds' attention toward the cross and we're reminded of the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, Father, that we give you praise and glory and honor for your salvation that you've continually done throughout history, but you've made it complete in Christ. It's in your Son's name that we pray. Amen.
Thank you for joining us for the Crosspoint Community Church podcast. It is our prayer that this message was encouraging to you as you follow Jesus. For more about Crosspoint Community Church, you can find us online at crosspointchurchtx.org. Have a great week.